What I'd like to just add in the introduction here is to say that if you were to look at any guest that you could have on this show, anybody in the mainstream, not a tabloid type person, but somebody who's always in the middle of something really interesting, that you could put your finger down on a random date on the calendar and say, I want to have this guest on because they're involved in all these kind of topical things that people are talking about at the water cooler. This guest certainly fits that bill, and there's not too many that are like her. I speak, of course, of the one and only Diane Diamond. Diane, we welcome you to the FDH Lounge. How are you tonight, ma'am?
Well, I'm overcome with that introduction, my goodness sakes. Thank you.
Well, as I say, we always like to go above and beyond, especially for somebody as accomplished as yourself. It's a pleasure to have you on the program here tonight.
Oh, thank you.
You are always involved in things that are very interesting. I'll tell you what, here's where I'll start, and we can get to some other matters from there. But in terms of word association, there are certain guests that we have on, like when I had Bob Barker on, the first thing we wanted to ask him about was Happy Gilmore. So certain things just come to mind. I will say, when it comes to you, the first thing that comes to mind, maybe just a little more unfortunate, but
I think I know what you're going to say here, Rick.
Maybe you do, maybe you don't. We'll see. Hold on to that thought, and we'll see how close you come on this. The first thought that I have, unfortunately, is shoot the messenger, because you really took a lot of garbage from all the Jacko fans, and why won't that mean lady stop saying stuff about our icon? And I see somebody really took a lot of slings and arrows from that crowd. So first and foremost, was that where you thought I was going to go?
Well, I thought you were going to go to Michael Jackson, okay. Yeah. But, that mean old lady, boy, that's tame compared to some of the stuff I get on my website.
I didn't say
especially
old.
Right after he died. You know, I've been covering him since 1993 when I worked for the TV show Hard Copy at the time, and we first reported the allegations that he might be a child molester. And from that point to the point of his death, it was pretty bad for me in terms of blowback from the fans. But after he died, it was crazy. It was crazy because these people collectively decided, I think they're all connected by the internet or through thought waves or something, that I had, my reporting starting in 93 had somehow made Michael Jackson go on drugs and made him get all the plastic surgery and have forced him to become crazy and forced him to kill himself. So, yeah, it got pretty bad.
By the way, and I want to clarify, when I was doing my falsetto impression of the average Jackson fan, I didn't say that mean old lady. I didn't put old in there.
Thank you, sir.
No, I would never do that. I'm a respectful person. And now, having said that, and again, I believe in accountability. I think we all do. And anybody who reads your columns and has followed your work understands that you believe in that as well. Having said that, though, if we're going to point a finger at anybody, in addition to Michael Jackson for anything that he did, one would think it would not be pointed at Diane Diamond, but rather Joe Jackson. I mean, if we're looking at who formed this guy, you know, I mean, look no further than the immediate family.
Right. Who was the dominating force in his life was his father, of course. But it was also his mother. You know, looking back at things and interviewing as many people as I have, I realized that Katherine Jackson wasn't just this passive person that sat around in her children's lives. She was an active participant and knew what was happening and allowed it to happen. And that's pretty sad. You know, Michael Jackson was the most talented, the thing that kept that family afloat and flush. The brothers were okay. They were kind of talented, most of them. But it was Michael Jackson who was the real talent. And for the rest of their lives, when he was 7 years old, he became the talent. And for the rest of his life, his brothers, not so much his sisters, but his brothers, his father, his mother, they all had their hand out to Michael. And can you imagine the pressure of that?
It really is just insane. That whole dynamic and just the way that everything went down over the years, and it's really interesting because we recently passed our 100th episode with the show here, and I was going back through.
Congratulations, that's great.
Thank you. I wasn't trolling for that, but thank you very much.
No, really, that's quite an achievement.
Thank you. No, I it was I wanted to mention, because we'd had on previously somebody who we really respect, who has an association with the show, longtime New York Post TV writer Adam Buckman.
I know Adam.
We love Adam. He's a good friend of ours. What a great guy. It stuck in my head as you were talking, Diane, because I was going through some of our archives recently. I went back to a conversation. Imagine talking to Adam not long after the MJ funeral last summer. I was engrossed just listening to me and him bantering about that afterwards, because it was so surreal. And so it was kind of sticking in my head as you were talking there about some things Adam was saying to me, and we were trying to make sense of everything that was happening. And all of the wave of nostalgia and the way that maybe people looked at things in a little bit of a weird kind of a way right at the point in time there, or wanted to believe that he was 100% innocent on everything, and that probably isn't rational. But the thing that I think Adam and I kind of came to a consensus on, and I don't know if you would agree with this or not, but I know that I personally, because again, I'm a child of, you know, when the Thriller album came out.
And
that's ingrained in my childhood. And that just, you know, growing up with the music. Now, I didn't like much of the stuff after Thriller, but Thriller and the stuff before it, Jackson 5 and all that kind of stuff, it's intertwined in your own life. And I think that's the grief people were feeling. It's not even this thing of, oh, it's so sad, you know, I love this guy, I'm too tied up in his life. As you know, there's a lot of sick people, Diane, that were too invested in him. But for the rest of us that were feeling really sad about this and maybe couldn't pinpoint it, it's probably because we felt like a piece of our own lives kind of was gone, because it was so intertwined with the music and the memories.
You hit it right on the head, I think, Rick, really. I mean, who didn't grow up with Michael Jackson? If you were 6 or 12 or 15 or 18, Michael Jackson has always been there in some way, form, or shape. And even when he got a little bizarre, started carving up his face and turning from black to white and all of that, the music endured, and the music still endures to this day. I mean, for goodness sake, his estate is making more money now than it ever was during the last years of his life, and it's because he really was a musical genius. But, you know, Quincy Jones said, sort of tongue-in-cheek, you know, I liked working with him, but he was a real perfectionist. And that's really why his music endures. It's like Fred Astaire. His dancing endures to this day because he was such a perfectionist at it. And so when the person who created all that dies, it has to touch all of us who, you know, grew up to the music, or were necking in the back seat to the music, or doing whatever you were doing in the back seat to the music, Rick. You know, it's a profound loss for all of us. Now, having said that, and having said that I think Michael Jackson was a musical genius, I was a little distressed at the time of his death that there was so much said about what a great guy he was, and how much he donated to charity, which in my mind was always in question, and was it the PR or was it the reality? And there was a dark side to this man that, during all the obituaries, and I was at the funeral for him, I was at the Staples Center Memorial, nothing about that was ever mentioned. And, of course, it shouldn't be mentioned at a memorial. Mm-hmm. But in all of the media coverage afterward, there wasn't a word mentioned about the boys, about the allegations, about the charges, about the criminal case. I thought that was a little disingenuous of us, the media.
Oh, it really was, and I'll tell you what, though, but as far as the way that fandom relates to stuff, I saw a little bit of a precursor to this two summers before. I can tell you this, and it's an odd thing to admit to now, but obviously I never knew about the man's double life. My favorite pro wrestler was Chris Benoit, because he was just amazing at what he did. And as soon as it came out that, you know, he offed his family and all these horrible things, like, okay, I'm never watching the DVDs again. The man, you know, no pun intended, he's dead to me. I'm closing this off from my life. There were denialists on message boards or people like, separate the work from what he did, the great matches. And I'm sitting here going, are you kidding me? He killed his 7-year-old son and then his wife. It just, there's the way that we attach ourselves to these people that we look up to for whatever reason. It really, you see it cross into unhealthiness at moments like this. That,
yeah.
You can't be a denialist, than I am.
You know, that's true. However, we're sort of programmed in this society when there is a death and when there is a funeral and when we're in the memorialization stage, oh, you never mention anything negative. You know, I wrote a book about Jackson, and mm-hmm. in the foreword, I write about this white-hot, blind worship we have of our celebrities. And when somebody is in that exalted a stage for so long, they're bound to fail us, you know, in some way, shape, or form. Benoit was a horrid example. Michael Jackson was an example to a lesser degree, but still, if you believe any of the allegations, and I tend to believe that there was some validity to them, then, you know, you have to look past the blind worship and say, after all, this was just a man with his frailties and his mental problems, or drug problems, whatever it happened to be. In Michael Jackson's case, it was all of those, and not be surprised by what happens. I'm always taken by how shocked we are that someone like Benoit. I don't know for sure, but I'm gonna just suggest that he was probably a steroid user, mm-hmm. probably, you know, a steroid roid rage kind of user, and so that he would go off and off his family. Should we be surprised? Mm-hmm. Should Michael Jackson, who starved himself and carved his face and may or may not have been inappropriate with young boys, are we surprised that he would put himself chemically to sleep every night and then, oopsie-daisy, he dies from it? No, we shouldn't be surprised.
No, we shouldn't be at all. And I'll tell you what, it's really, you know, the way that you tied it together there in the two cases, I think, is absolutely correct. And in the case of Michael Jackson, again, anybody that wants to be a denialist on this stuff, until you can explain away the young boys who can give the, shall we say, identifying characteristics, until somebody can explain that away, you can't in clear conscience be called anything other than an apologist.
You know, so many people to me over the years have said, well, you know, if Michael Jackson was a child molester, how come there was only one? Okay, or maybe two. And to that, of course, in my book I write that there weren't just one or two. There were many families who came forward and asked in anguish, what have you done to our son? But rather than go public and rather than try to press charges or go through a trial, they chose to go away quietly with some money, with some help, with some, you know, a house or cars or whatever it was, and the public never heard from them. So, you know, when we look back at our celebrities and we think about, we'll say Charlie Sheen. Mm-hmm. I mean, he's in a heap of trouble right now, domestic violence charges again. He once shot a girlfriend in the arm, for goodness sakes. Are we surprised that he held a knife to his wife's neck? These people have lives that we don't even know about. We may get a little bit of the peaks and valleys, but they have lives that we cannot even imagine. And when we start to report on them, then we're suddenly tabloid reporters. But I say we should know about the people we put on pedestals and our children worship, and, to not talk about it is even worse than talking too much about it.
You're right about that, and I think any fair-minded person would say there's you know, three continents worth of space between your work and that of Kitty Kelly. You're
we have the same agent, coincidentally.
Do you? Okay.
Yes, we do.
Well, I hope I didn't get you in trouble with the agent with that remark, but no. You're approaching things. These are titillating subjects, but they're interesting ones, and I feel, again, I think most fair-minded people would say you're obviously handling these, you know, in a dignified manner. That book, by the way, it's good that you have this link to on your bio on your website on DianeDiamond.com. Be Careful Who You Love, Inside the Michael Jackson Case, an excellent book. By the way, and I should
Thank you.
This to your attention, Diane, the first thing that comes up in a Google search for you is DianeDiamond.net. So you might want to petition Google to see if they can switch that to the .com.
Well, you know, I'll tell you a funny story about that, Rick, very quickly. Years ago, before we ever even really heard of the Internet, I was at Hard Copy, and I got a notice from somebody that they had bought my name, DianeDiamond.com, and I thought, well, who cares? I don't care. Flash forward many years, I want to set up a website, and this person who bought my name now wants $8,000. For DianeDiamond.com. Now, I am a little scotch, okay? I'm going to admit, I'm a little thrifty in my life. And I just thought, that's crazy. So I started DianeDiamond.net. The man contacted me again, and he sold it to me for $300. So I bought it, and they both connect to each other. So
yes.
Doesn't matter, DianeDiamond.net or .com, you get to the same place.
Nice job. Way to stare down the cyber squatters
there. I did. It took me a lot of years, man, but I guess I still paid him money, though. It just galled me.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, wow.
People that do that, there are too many anything to make a buck type of people that are out there. Your career, of course, again, you know, it has spanned, as I said at the outset here, many platforms because of your work presently with your column, of course, all of your radio work, which you know, predated a lot of your high profile TV stuff. You've gone back to your radio roots recently here with some terrestrial stuff that's being podcast also on the internet as well. I understand that that's been a great success as well. So you've been on many different platforms long before the internet kind of made it in vogue to do so.
You know, I think I'm just a restless soul. And I started in radio at KOB in Albuquerque, New Mexico, which is now KKOB. And I went to National Public Radio, and I went to radio, covered Capitol Hill for radio. And then somehow, I don't really know, but I got into television and print, and I just enjoy telling stories, you know, Rick? And if it's writing, I write for the dailybeast.com a lot. Mm-hmm. Been writing about John Edwards and John Mark Carr, the crazy lunatic who said he killed JonBenet Ramsey. He's now changed his gender. He's now a woman, but he's overstepped the law, and he has started issuing death threats to people. So I wrote about him recently. I just... you know, my parents grew up in North Dakota and Canada, right up at the Canadian border. And there were farm kids, and they didn't have television. They had some radio. But what they did at night was sit around and tell stories. And this is what I grew up with when all the relatives visited us in Albuquerque, New Mexico. And I think I just became enamored with the talent of true storytelling. It is a real talent. I'm not sure I have it, but I try very hard. And so whether it's print or radio or TV, I just keep hammering away.
Well, we admire the versatility. It's good to be able to do that. I have to mention, and this is something I was going to mention even before you brought up Albuquerque here, but I have to ask you, the thing that I think in the last 3 years or so that most people tend to associate with that, I have to ask you, do you watch Breaking Bad?
A little bit.
Okay.
I do, and I really enjoy it. You know, I live now in New York, north of Manhattan. Very different sort of atmosphere than when I grew up, very different geography. And when I watch that program, I'm back home. You know, I still have my childhood home in Albuquerque, but I'm renting it out, so I don't get back there often. And when I watch that show, everything is not green where I live now, but it's all beige.
Mm-hmm.
And nothing is tall. There are no skyscrapers. It's all adobe flat roofs. And it takes me back. I do like that show. You?
Oh, I love it. I love it. I believe it's certainly one of the best ones on TV. And the thing, the Sunday night, the penultimate episode for the season was just, they've had like three episodes this year that I would classify as some of the biggest heart stoppers I've ever seen on TV. What I'm wondering about, because again, you know, so much of it's done on location, as you alluded to, mm-hmm. I always see in the credits at the end that the city of Albuquerque, you know, they participate, they cooperate, they get a promotional mention there. And in a sense, it's very flattering things being shown about the area visually. In another sense, it's a real underbelly kind of a situation. I'm always just kind of intrigued that a city is that enamored of associating with a show which talks about their violent meth trade.
But listen, you got to realize when I grew up in Albuquerque in the decade, we were number one in crime per capita in America.
Really?
We were number one in bank robberies and murders and per capita. And so now, you know, we're so far down the list, it's great. You know, Governor Richardson, who I know for a lot of years, he's a piece of work, that guy. But the one really prescient thing he did was he said, you know what? Hollywood's getting too expensive to make movies. New York is getting too expensive. I'm going to lure them all here. and they gave great tax breaks. He set up the New Mexico Film Commission, and then they extended it to episodic television. It's been a real boon to Albuquerque, because when I go back, I still have cousins and best friends from school there. You go downtown now, it's all revitalized, and the avenues are, well, they're not even really avenues, but the main streets are lined with those trailers from movie production houses. Mm-hmm. You know, there's the makeup trailer and the chow trailer and the, you know, whatever. And there's a real revitalization of downtown Albuquerque and Santa Fe and Taos, all the way up to Farmington in the north, because he did that. It's a really smart thing, I think.
Yeah, I think it clearly, yeah, it sounds like it's having a real impact, and that's I think a treat for our listeners to be able to hear about your perspective on that, because I'm sure we have a lot of people in our audience that really love that show, and it's great to kind of hear a little bit about the behind the scenes of the area. I alluded to this a minute ago as well here, in terms of your radio roots, again, sort of returning to them a little bit. I understand one of your more prominent projects at the moment is doing a terrestrial radio show that actually is getting worldwide notice and availability on the internet as well.
Are you talking about Talk It Over?
Yes.
Talk It Over Radio. You know, I have always been associated with hard news, politics. I covered politics in Washington for many, many years for NPR and RKO radio networks, and then crime. But, you know, one thing I learned covering those things is that it is the human behavior that guides everything that happens. Why do we do the things we do? And so the Talk It Over radio program features a mediator. His name is Lee J. Berman, a humorist, a comedian named Louise Palanker, who's hysterically funny. She has a great sense of humor about life in general. And then me, sort of the hard news journalist. And people write in to ask how to handle their personal dilemmas. How do you deal with that boss that won't listen to you, or that miserable in-law, or the next-door neighbor whose dog barks all night long? How is it that you can best deal with them so that they hear you? Not that you can confront them and make them feel bad and they capitulate and do what you want, but that they really hear you and hear your concern. And so our mediator, Lee J. Berman, gives people great advice. You can check it out on talkitoverradio.com. Great advice on how to deal with those people in your life that you really want to hit over the head with a baseball bat. But then, of course, there'll be assault charges against you, and that doesn't get you anywhere. So how do you talk to these people? And it's been a real revelation, Rick. I really like that program. I hope that more terrestrial radio stations will pick it up, but they're awfully busy doing conservative politics, so we'll keep our fingers crossed.
That does kind of predominate the airwaves. And I have to say, too, it's very interesting. I should touch on this as well with your one column on here, The Lesson of Joe Sestak. I appreciated it because, again, from my perspective and politically, I'm not a partisan. I'm a paleocon. That kind of leaves me without a home, so to speak, here. But I'm somebody who, again, I'm largely against the things that are almost completely, I'd say, against the things happening with this administration. But I want to pull my hair out when I see things being said and done just for partisan purposes, because I think there's enough substantive things, if you want to nail the guy on, to do that. You look silly. You tick off the people in the middle if you just throw mud on stuff like that. So it's interesting because, in a way, you were kind of speaking to people like me, Republicans who are kind of a little bit frustrated with some of the things other Republicans are saying right now about the situation in Washington, because you called out Bill Clinton in this column, and I think you were right to do so. Just because something happened before, and probably the same thing did repeatedly, is no reason to continue to tolerate it now. And we don't have this even standard of it's right or wrong regardless of whoever's in office. I happen to believe the same things are right or wrong regardless of administration. So because of that, I really found your column to be very resonant.
Well, thank you. You know, I did cover politics for a long time in Washington. I covered the White House, covered Capitol Hill. And I try in my column, which is posted on my website every Monday, not to engage in politics, but to just talk about common sense stuff to keep us all safe. But when somebody starts talking about a former president of the United States, Bill Clinton, committing a violation of federal election law by going to somebody and saying, hey, Democrat, please don't run against this other Democrat for the United States Senate seat because we'd rather have him than you. He has more seniority, Arlen Specter, than you, Joe Sisak, who's an admiral in the Navy for 30 years, for goodness sake. But please don't run. What kind of job can we give you so that you don't run? Hello? That's against the Hatch Act. That's against federal election law. That is punishable by a fine and up to a year in prison. Well, I am not naive enough to think that anything is ever going to happen to Bill Clinton, the man who said, I did not have sexual relations with that woman, who now we know he did. But I'm sick of everybody on the Sunday morning talk shows, all the talk shows, saying, oh, come on, you know, that's just the way politics works. Well, you know what? I don't want it to work like that. This is my tax dollars going to these politicians. I'm not a teabagger. I'm not a Democrat. I've been a registered independent my whole life. I'm tired of what has happened to politics. I used to stand in front of Tip O'Neill every day as a young cub reporter, and he would tell us what was going to happen in the United States Congress. Here was the schedule, and then he would open it up to questions. And as much as he would not like an opposing party's legislation, he would go out with them that night to the local steakhouse and have a conversation about it. There was no public mudslinging on the floor of the House. There was no denigration of the other party. There were probably some dirty tricks, but few and far between. And what politics has become today, I don't know about you, but boy, as my daughter used to say, it makes me want to gag me with a spoon.
Oh yeah.
We're so paralyzed by indecision and inactivity that, you know, what's happening? Nothing. Is health care getting solved? No. Social Security getting solved? No. How about the tax base? I think I pay too much in taxes. You? Nothing's getting solved. It's just a partisan bickering mess.
And I'll tell you what, a friend of our show, when we first had him on the show, former Congressman Joe DiGuardi from New York, I said to him, I'm going to say nice things about you. I said, I rarely do about any politician. I said, you're a principled guy. I said, you got turfed out of office because you wouldn't tell people what they wanted to hear. You can count it on one hand the number of people who will do that. By the same token, as long as we're talking about a uniform standard here, Diane, it seems kind of amusing to me. You could take some comments made by some of the Democrats in the wake of Katrina about the massive federal incompetence down in the Gulf area now. Boy, if you were to play them back now, that would be kind of uncomfortable. It seems to me you can kind of get hoist on the petard of when you're out of office, oh, the federal government should be omnipotent, able to solve every massive problem like this. Then you get in office, a massive problem occurs in the same backyard, you can't clean it up, and your previous words kind of come back to bite you a little bit, maybe.
And you can't shrug your shoulders and say, well, gosh, Washington can't do everything. You know, in my heart of hearts, I don't want Washington to do everything. I want Washington to get the hell out of the way. When Barack Obama the other day said, and then one of his energy secretaries reiterated, we have been in charge of this oil spill mess from the very beginning. Nothing has gotten done until it's been approved by us. And I looked at my husband, who is an anchorman at CBS Radio here in New York, and I said, aha! That's why it's taken so damn long to shut this oil spill off. Everything they've had to do, they've had to promulgate the regulations through the EPA and the Coast Guard and the, you know, God knows what sort of government body. Who do you think knows how to cap that thing better than anybody? And, you know, P.S., nobody knows how to deal with anything level because we've never had it. It ain't Washington. It's the oil companies. And now that the emergency has happened, I beg Washington, step the heck out of the way and let the experts move in unfettered and stop the leak. What is it now, 45 days or something?
Uh-huh.
If this had happened under George Bush, there would be petitions to impeach him.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's no question about that. And It's one of these things where, again, and again, I'm somebody that's pretty much anti-big government myself. So it's a matter where I can't help but be amused in a situation like this. Again, as far as that's where you're setting the bar, that's where you're setting the standard. And again, unlike a lot of Republicans, I always conceded that Bush did a horrible job with Katrina. Having said that, I thought the state and local governments came up short also. By the same token, I have to laugh now. My Republican friends don't want to hear this, but I laugh with them and I say, Karl Rove is calling this Obama's Katrina. I didn't know Karl Rove believed that Bush had a Katrina. That's kind of funny.
Exactly. You know, I'm really one of those states' rights people. I guess I say I'm an independent, but I'm probably really a libertarian. Mm-hmm. I just want the federal government to provide me with national defense and take a little bit of my taxes and spread them out for that and some other very essential services. And other than that, leave me alone. But I don't want to make this whole big Katrina debate here, but I would submit to you that it was the state down there and the governor down there and the mayor, Nagin, down there during Katrina that really fell short. Mm-hmm. I mean, you have some problems. Tell us what they are. Tell us what you need. And the American people will galvanize and help you out. I mean, when there were huge floods in North Dakota in the middle of the country, nobody said, hey, where's the government? They just all lined up and made big sandbag dikes. Mm-hmm. And they kept the floods at bay as best they could, and then they cleaned it up afterward. Now, Katrina was a horrible thing, horrible, terrible, but it was that state of Louisiana's politicians, in my viewpoint, that were the first line of defense, and they failed miserably. From helping people in hospitals and nursing homes to the people stuck in the sports stadium to petitioning Washington for help. I mean, according to my sources in Washington, Washington waited for days and days and days to hear, what do you need? You know, there's a female governor down there. How would it look for George Bush to go riding in on his horse saying, all right, little lady, get out of the way. Washington is here to take over. So he waited. What do you need, Governor? And she never said, and she never said, and she never said. So, I mean, books will be written about this and have already been written about this. There was enough blame on that to go around, as with this oil spill. You know, I think a lot is not being said about how many people were involved in, quote, the control of this oil well. BP owned the well. But another company owned the platform, and another company was in charge of the that valve that was supposed to stop the blowouts. And then there was another company that staffed the rig. And then, you know, we have specialized ourselves into paralysis in this country. You know, you go to your doctor and you say, doctor, I got this pain in my knee, and he says, oh, you got to go to an orthopedist. Sorry.
Yeah.
You know, we have so many specialists in this country, right down to our oil rigs offshore, that there's nobody who can handle anything at first blush.
That's a very good point. That's an excellent point. And as far as, you know, the potential role of gender politics in the whole Katrina thing, too, I mean, I agree with you. I never thought of it that way before. But, yeah, it would have looked horribly condescending had it gone down that way and Bush just elbowing aside the locals, particularly the governor. That's an excellent point as well. And this now, this almost horrible bookend, you know, really to what the Gulf has gone through. You know,
it's horribly sad, that whole region down there.
Oh, and the devastation of the fishing and the shrimping industries and everything like that. The scale of this thing just has the potential to be, it's unbelievable. You know, when New Orleans was awarded the Super Bowl, I think for 2013, they were saying, oh, well, you know, Katrina will be well in the rearview mirror. The healing will be well underway. Mm-hmm. We're going to barely be, you know, into the healing process from this thing by the time New Orleans gets their Super Bowl.
You know, I have a dear friend named Stephanie Kovac who is making a documentary, still looking for funding to complete it, called Tide of Tears. And it is a documentary that she started several years ago about the diminishment of the Louisiana coastline because the Army Corps of Engineers didn't think things through, and because of the erosion of the coast, the Cajun culture is disappearing. The fishermen there, the shrimp stocks, the fish stocks, it had been disappearing at this huge, enormous rate before Katrina, before the oil spill, before all of these terrible things that we, you know, have seen recently. And I talked to her the other day. She lives in Dallas, Texas, and she said to me, sobbing, I'm selling my house in Dallas, and I am moving to New Orleans, to the area. I'm moving to the Gulf, and I'm going to clean up. And I thought to myself, you're 5'4". Mm-hmm. You're one woman. What are you going to do?
Yeah.
But it will take that sort of gumption, I think, to try to tackle this problem. And even with that gumption, it's going to take a decade or more to really, really clean it up.
Yeah, you'd have to think, sadly enough, that's the time frame they're looking at. By the way, we can arrange this off air. I'd love to get your friend booked for the show here to talk about this documentary if she'd like to call attention to. Sure, that would be an excellent thing. We are the show, after all, where nothing is off topic, as we've kind of demonstrated with you here tonight. We've covered an awful lot of stuff. But Diane, I feel like we just hit the tip of the iceberg. I'd love to get you back on. What are the things here, in addition to, of course, your investigative reports for the Entertainment Tonight, and you have information about that linked off of your website at dianediamond.com. What else didn't we pimp for you here tonight that we should be?
Not a thing. I'm as I'm talking to you, I'm watching my Yankees have just pulled ahead of Baltimore 3-2 in the bottom of the sixth. So that's the only thing. Other thing I want to pimp is my New York Yankees.
Well, you're fortunate to have a team like that to root for. My favorite's the Cleveland Indians. I'm not so fortunate. We were laughing about this earlier in the show. Steven Strasburg, you know, with his big debut last night.
Oh, sure.
His first road game is going to be here in Cleveland on Sunday. This shameless organization, they are promoting the battle of the young phenoms, Steven Strasburg against David Huff. And I mean, that is just shysterism of the worst degree. You know, I'm sure with all the Hollywood coverage you've seen, you'd probably be hard-pressed to have seen something as shameless as that.
Yeah, I was talking to my husband, who's a huge Yankee fan. In fact, he is the voice of the Yankees here in New York, one of the image voices. And I said to him, what is this with this new phenom out there, this pitcher? And he said, I've never seen anything like it in all my years of watching baseball. And he's a huge fan. But you know what? It's like Tiger Woods. He is golf, or he was golf anyway. He's not doing so well right now. Major League sports are smart. They hook on to the phenoms and they try to build up the fever, and it works.
Yeah,
here we are talking about it. It works.
It's certainly amazing how it's going, and the kid lived up to it and then some night. But it was just amazing. But Diane, I feel like we only just really hit the tip of the iceberg.
Well, you call me back, Rick, anytime, and I will give your producer the name of my friend who's doing that documentary, because she is really committed to the cause down there.
Well, thank you so much, because, again, we love a good conversation. We love something where we can hit a lot of different topics with an interesting person, and this was tremendous. This was a big thrill for us tonight, Diane. Please don't be a stranger.
Hey, you got my number now, but just don't pass it out.
All right. We will keep it under our literal hat here. So, all right, thank you so much, Diane.
Thanks, Rick. Have a good night.